Good morning, Kansas City. Last winter, the Public Programs Office at the Nelson Atkins Museum put out a call to artists through several channels such as Artist Inc., the Artist Coalition, Light in the Upper Room, and the Charlotte Street Foundation. The idea was for artists to submit proposals for adult studio classes as a way to broaden the Nelson Atkins community ties and programming options. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFault. Today, we're going to find out the result of those efforts. We now welcome Krishan McKinney, educator for public programs at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and local fabrics artist Sony Press to the studio for a discussion about that adult studio program at the Nelson Atkins. Krishan McKinney, tell us about what the intentions of the Nelson was when it sent out this proposal to artists.
Well, first of all, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming on the show, both of you.
It's great to be here. Well, the idea was that we have a great staff and great educational programming with the museum, but we wanted to give our local artists an opportunity to share their talents with us and give them a chance to enhance our curriculum. So, like you said, we put out the call for artists to submit proposals for this adult studio program, and we had some fantastic results. You mentioned Charlotte Street. We also approached the Artist Coalition, Light in the Other Room, and Artist Inc., and once again, just fantastic response. And we came up with two great classes, collage and painting, and then the art of journaling. And once again, we just wanted our Kansas City artists to feel at home with us at the Nelson, and we wanted to be engaged with what they were doing with their artwork in their lives and give them a chance to showcase that here at the museum.
I can imagine several proposals came in. How did you end up choosing these two particular proposals, the art of journaling and the collage and painting proposals?
Well, we looked at what could be done at the museum involving our collections. As you know, we have a fantastic broad collection of work. And the collage and painting, that was a great class for people that were kind of looking for an introduction into painting. And then the art of journaling class, we just love the idea that you're combining two artistic aspects, the journal making and then also the creative writing element. And they were going to be focusing on our Afro collection, and we just thought that would be a fantastic combination.
We're going to learn about that journaling program in a minute with our other guest here, Sony Press. But first, Krishan, tell us about your background as an artist and how it helps you foster the need to stay engaged with other artists in the community.
Well, you know, when it comes to the art world, you're learning so much, and there's so much influence in terms of what artists can bring to the table. And I've always been involved in art, always loved art. My education is in it as well. But
you're a painter as well.
That's right, right. A mural painter. Before I came here to Kansas City, I was a mural painter. And we were working with the community. So that kind of just comes hand in hand. You know, you're working with communities, you're working with other museums, you're working with schools, you're working with city leaders. So it's a great partnership.
Why is it so important for the Nelson Atkins to stay engaged with local artists? It's a big internationally known institution, well-respected around the country as well. Why is it important for the Nelson to remain engaged?
Well, because we still want to have our local artists feel like they are part of this institution. Like you said, we're certainly a world-renowned museum, but we still want for artists that are here at home to know that this is their museum. This place belongs to them as well.
Speaking of artists here at home, Sony, what made you answer the call to get involved in this program? And tell us a little bit about the art of journaling.
It was an important opportunity. It gave me an opportunity to participate with the Nelson and their new program. And when you have an outreach like that, you're broadening your community, giving them an opportunity to be participatory at the museum as well. Journaling is extremely cathartic. It allows you ownership into your own creative process. So in creating the books for the journaling workshop, we were able to start at the very beginning. So literally utilizing cardboard, fabric, paper, things of that sort that are interesting.
It's a very organic process
extremely,
as well, too. both artistically and expressively. And you brought with you today two samples of the books that you make as a fabrics artist. One of them is composed of a mud cloth and African cowrie shells, very Afrocentric, with a brown paper bag pages inside. Talk about that sort of organic, artistic, expressive
recycling is important. And when you have an opportunity to create something like that, that becomes your own, and you're not throwing anything away, so you're using exactly what you have, so it isn't an expensive process at all. Mud cloth, of course, comes from the motherland, as I say, and it gives a natural look to what you're creating. We also incorporate paper along with fabric and creating a scene on the book.
The scene on the back of this book that you're holding up right now for our audience is of a tree, almost like a ancestral family tree, and a bunch of zebras are lighted under it, and it's got some very colorful ethnic Moorish border designs at the top and at the bottom. Very beautiful. We'll probably have some pictures of these journals on our website at kcur.org for our listeners to peruse. Tell us about the whole aspect of how students, adult students, will come in, design their own books that they can then journal in.
What they're going to do, the foundation, of course, is the cardboard. And then they choose the papers, they choose the fabrics, the things that they would like to use to create their books. Then they can collage their books as this book has been collaged, utilizing paper and fabric as well. The process, though, is the hand sewing of the book. And it's an easy process. It looks difficult, but it isn't difficult at all because they're physically sewing 10 pages, which become 20 pages for their book.
And Glenn North is collaborating with
Absolutely.
You, a very well-known local writer and definitely a friend of Central Standard, from having come in and participated in our Poetry Ranga and a couple
Absolutely.
Of other shows. What does he bring to the table?
He brings the art of writing and writing poetry, giving one a voice within the pages through the writing process. So he will have a week and a half as a part of the workshop itself in working with people through the writing process.
Tell us how your background in weaving together quilts, a long storied tradition in the African American community, tell us about how that background plays into this.
It's extremely important because we're utilizing textiles. I'm actually a textile artist, and we are patchworking a story into a story. This gives a person an opportunity to touch fabrics that they may not on a normal basis normally touch. We're utilizing African wax print, mud cloth. The wax print is actually from Ghana, from Africa. The mud cloth, of course, is from Ghana, and mud cloth is a community-made product. So it gives them an opportunity to work with fabrics that they would probably normally not work with. Quilting within the African-American community is a story process and a community process, which allows people within the community to work together.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are Krishan McKinney, educator for public programs at the Nelson Atkin Museum of Art, and fabrics and textiles artist, Sony Press. They're both in the studio for a discussion of adult studio classes at the Nelson Atkins. Sony, you are clamoring to say something.
I was. It's important for this process to take place for artists within our community. It gives us ownership. It gives us a voice within our community. And when these opportunities are presented to the artist, I urge every artist to apply to what the Nelson Atkins is doing and what they're willing to do for local artists within our community.
That leads me to this question. How is making art different from teaching art? And I'll come to you in a minute, Krishan.
It's very different because it is hands-on. Arts is actually a hands-on process. However, the journaling process with fiber, paper, it all goes hand-in-hand together.
How about you, Krishan? How is making art different from teaching art?
It is very much like what Sunny was saying, a hands-on process. And sometimes it's actually hard to separate the two, the making and the teaching, because you are creating these things with your students. They're learning from you, but you are also making the artwork, and they are seeing that process. So it is kind of hard to separate the two. But, you know, I'm just thinking about with my own experiences, there are times though where I'm making that work and it would be hard for me to translate to someone else. Well, here are your steps. This is what you do. Sometimes it gets tricky trying to figure that out.
Some people say a lot of the trick to art teaching is bringing out the artist within the person that you're teaching, not necessarily teaching the technique or the process, but bringing those things out, bringing that artist, bringing that creativity out of the person you're teaching, giving them the steps, giving them mm-hmm. the template, but letting them express themselves.
Right. And you're influencing each other.
Absolutely.
Through that process. Sometimes students will do something with their work that you as the artist and the teacher say, oh, you know what? That's something that's interesting to me that I can also try out.
It's very true. Because it lends itself, again, to the creative process. A majority of the time when you're working within a classroom setting, there's a bit of fear and you're recreating trust. So there's a building of trust within oneself in, for instance, sewing together paper by hand, sewing together fabric by hand. There's a bit of a fear sometimes when you're even trying to thread a needle. What that allows you to do is grow through the process. It has allowed me to grow because as I'm teaching, I'm learning. As Krishan said, you're learning through that process, so it does go hand in hand.
And I think just to jump in, Sunny was mentioning the idea of fear. And with adult programs or classes, sometimes there is that fear. You know, you don't want to mess up. You don't want to do the right thing or you don't want to do the wrong thing. But I think what's great with what we have at the Nelson, the dynamic is that our teachers are very open, very giving, and they make it possible for adults to come in and to create and to feel good about the decisions that they're making. Because, like I said, sometimes you can get caught up in, well, is that going to be the right thing to do? And here, it is the right thing to do. It's your expression.
So when you talk about the importance of arts education in general, we're seeing a lot of education programs going by the wayside. And how does what you do and what's going on here fill that gap?
It's extremely important. We have a generation of young people that are not interested in the arts. This opens the door for them to have an opportunity to come in and express themselves and see what the possibilities are for them. We're losing arts within communities across the country. As stated, I spoke with a friend earlier today that is working diligently in the Los Angeles area as the arts are concerned. Art saves lives, mm-hmm. period. That's exactly what it does. You're an artist. Performing arts, visual arts. We have organizations here in Kansas City that understand that, and they're opening doors for young people to be participatory within the arts.
Now, is the generation not interested in art, or have we as leaders, civic leaders, town fathers and mothers, not made art enough of a priority?
We've not made it enough of a priority. I'm a product of art. I'm a product of the free programs. I come from that generation where all summer long you were participatory in arts programs, and it builds trust within your community. It builds opportunities. It opens up doors. It broadens your horizons. It brings you into a particular place, and it introduces you to other cultures. It allows you to be who you are, to be your creative self. And when you have that, you don't have the violence. When you have the ability to express yourself, you don't have the confusion or the convoluted situations that occur. What art does, it frees you up to be expressive, whether visually, performance, literarily. You know, it gives you all of that.
Is that what you mean by art saves lives?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it does save lives.
Talk about the importance of art education, Krishan.
It's so important because it gives people an opportunity to challenge and kind of gives them an opening to dealing with things, dealing with issues, a creative way to address those things. And, you know, with the arts and the importance of art education, you get an opportunity to be expressive. And as Sunny says, learning about different cultures, learning about different styles. And I think for me, what's so important is that you learn just how significant art is in your everyday lives. You make decisions about what you want to wear, and when I'm working with teenagers, we have this conversation a lot. I was like, you make an artistic decision every day when you got up and decided what you were going to wear, how you're going to do your hair, or what kind of shoes you were going to put on. You're making a decision that's based on your taste and your style, and that's artistic.
One of our regular guests, Jose Faust, has a saying that I like and that I've incorporated, that our life is our biggest art project. I'm paraphrasing, but That's the profundity
true.
Of
it, yes,
that.
Yes, that's very true.
Who else is involved in this artistic endeavor? Tell us about the collage and painting class, and then we'll get back to the journaling class.
Okay, well, Nicole Mauser is teaching the collage and painting class. And once again, that's an adult class. And so that's giving them an opportunity to kind of merge two mediums together. You might think of collage as one thing and painting as something else. And she's giving people an opportunity, the students an opportunity to see how those two can merge and how they can influence each other. And she's giving them the courage to really play around with the materials. Because once again, you always have to break down those barriers of fear. Oh, I don't know if that's going to be the right decision. They're having a great time. And the students are certainly having a great time in Sunny and Glenn's class also. It's great energy, a lot of warmth. I love that Sunny brings her own music. And play, because that's certainly very influential, too.
What music do you bring, Sammy?
Jazz and gospel, of course. Absolutely. It allows you to be comfortable.
And that's certainly something very important, and I think that's what we want at the museum, is for our audience to feel comfortable.
Now, you've had a lot of experience with collages coming up, Sunny. Talk about your experiences as a childhood and a teenager and who you'd cut out of magazines and paste all over the place and make books that are similar to what you have in front of you.
This is more of a sophisticated process as to when I started in high school a long time ago. And we would purchase these black and white composition books. And at the time, Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, 17 Magazine, we would cut out the pictures of the various iconic figures, put them and glue them on the books, so that we would have something different. They just weren't the same. And I like that. We would incorporate fabric as well. And it became your book. It became something that you used. I still have one of them tucked away in a trunk with letters and notes that we would pass in class and things like that. It gave me ownership. It gave me identity. It was important.
Talk about the importance of keepsakes.
Keepsakes are extremely important because it allows you to go back to your past to see how far you've grown, what you've accomplished, what you've been able to do. Keepsakes within the quilt community tells a powerful story because it's an important history.
And journaling is probably among the biggest keepsakes that we have as human beings to record our lives and record our thoughts and record the events that shape and affect us. But for the purpose of this, journaling is very personal. So how do you draw that out?
Very carefully, you show the person that they're in a safe environment, that they have the opportunity to create on their own, and you give them the tools by which to do that, which is, believe it or not, needle, thread, paper, and fabric. Very simple. And you don't make it complicated. You allow them the freedom to create their own journal. Journaling is very cathartic. It does allow you to write down your thoughts and your feelings and plan out possibly what you're wanting to do from day to day or from year to year.
What about the end product? Is there going to be a community presentation or engagement, like an event that comes at the end of the class term where the students will share their work in collages? I can see it. In journaling, it seems like that's going to take a little bit of a nuanced approach.
I think what would happen is the outside of their journals would be shown and would be seen.
The inside of the journals
and the
remain
inside,
private.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So where does the instruction on crafting the narrative of the journal and poetry come in if it's going to be a very private
deal? That's a question for Glenn.
That is a question for Glenn.
That is definitely a question for Glenn North. I can't answer that question for you.
But in putting that course together, you guys discussed that. I'm
we did discuss it, and the outside of the books are beautiful, and they're considered art. The inside is something that belongs inside of you. That's your heart. That's your soul.
So you can never judge a book by its cover.
Absolutely not.
Kind of what you're saying.
Absolutely not.
So what will someone or some people who take part in these courses, Krishan, come out with? What knowledge and skill sets do you expect them or want them to depart with?
I want them to feel comfortable with the decisions that they're able to make, feel comfortable with their sense of what art is. And I want them to know that the Nelson is a place that they can come and learn, but also a place that they can kind of just come and relax, hang out, and get to know the Nelson, get to know the people at the Nelson.
Sonia, you've also done some curatorial work with the Jazz Museum here in Kansas City. How is working with the Jazz Museum and becoming ensconced in the African-American culture here in the city informed your creative process? You've also done a quilt project of the Negro League baseball teams as well. How does learning about the local history?
It's extremely important. It helps the creative process. You have the opportunity of getting to know the community, the cultural community, and the contributions that they've made within this community. Kansas City is rich in history. Performing arts, visual arts, again, within the arts. Worldwide, Kansas City is respected within the jazz community as well. Working at the American Jazz Museum has been a very positive experience for me. I've grown through the process, and it has allowed me.
How so?
How have I grown? I've learned a lot about jazz. I've learned a lot about the past. If you don't know your past, you don't know where you're going. You don't know what your future is going to be. I've had the opportunity of working with some phenomenal artists, Ed Dwight, who's originally from Kansas City, Kansas. I've worked with Jose Pellicer, who allowed us to partner with the Mexican consulate in Africans in Mexico. That was a phenomenal exhibition to be able to curate and be participatory with, and in partnering with other organizations, Mattie Rhodes Art Center as well. Cultural art is powerful, and in sharing our story as a community, not just the African-American community, the world community, it's extremely important through the arts. Again, it brings education. It brings trust. It allows you to broaden your scope. And as a visiting curator with the American Jazz Museum, that's what it's allowed me to do.
You have some interesting projects coming up. What do you have coming up, Sony?
I'm working on a project called My Mother's Club. I had the opportunity of working with Rodney Thompson and Stinson McClendon as they worked on the film My Mother's Club. And I'm creating 47 quilts around the story of the African-American female and male social clubs here in Kansas City.
And what was unique about those social clubs?
The one thing that comes to mind that was extremely important is that they stopped Kansas City. They closed Kansas City down. These women were not allowed to eat at the lunch counters after shopping.
The March on Kansas City.
The March on Kansas City. And the piece that I'm creating is called The March on KC, where these women organized themselves and they went to the correct officials, and they went to the various department store managers and talked with them, and still didn't get any results. So the end result was for them to march on Kansas City. They organized themselves. They realized how important their dollars were to the economy within Kansas City, and they closed it down. They closed Kansas City down for a few days by marching on Kansas City.
We'll definitely be interested in having you back to talk about that project as it unfolds. What's going on at the Nelson coming up, Krishan?
Well, there are two things I would love to touch base on. The first is our adult scholarship program, which is tied to the adult proposal classes that we have going on. For many years, we've had scholarships that we've offered to our youth, but we are now offering scholarships for adults who would like to take a class but cannot afford the expense. And we currently have some of our adult scholarship participants in the Art of Journaling class. And so anyone who would be interested in finding out more can give me a call at 816-751-1372. And then the other upcoming event that we have, I'm very excited about, we have a new adult series called Art Dynamic. And that is a free event, free series, October 4th. From 6:30 to 8:30 at the museum will be our Art Dynamic Masquerade theme. And we're going to have tours of the African Gallery as well as our Picasso exhibit. We have happy hour happening. And then we have the Asoke Cultural Center who will be performing live. They're going to be doing drumming and dancing. And we've got a mask making activity. So that's going to be a fantastic free event October 4th.
And we have that information that you just heard. If you didn't hear it all, we'll have that information up on our website at kcur.org. We've been discussing adult studio classes and continuing adult education at the Nelson Atkins Museum. Our guests are Krishan McKinney, educator for public programs at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, and fabrics and textiles artist Sony Press. Thank you, ladies, for coming by.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we return, our education thread continues with a look at the College Entrance Exam Prep Program from the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. We want to hear from you about your thoughts on standardized testing as well. As we prepare for that upcoming discussion, Kansas City, what are your tips for children on preparing for standardized tests and college entrance exams? What do you think about college entrance exams in general? Are they the proper barometer for our kids entering college? Or do you find that these exams are unfair, culturally biased, outdated? Whatever. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and our Twitter handle is KCURCST. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Cramming the night before will hurt more than it helps, so get plenty of rest the day before, and in the morning, don't overthink it. Relax, breathe, and do your best. The average advice for a college entrance exam could very well apply to other tests in life as well. At least that's what the Urban League of Greater Kansas City has in mind. The Urban League has long had a program for underprivileged students who might not be able to pay for expensive test prep services, and they provide those services in kind for the community. It's that time of year for college prep and college apps and entrance exams. Before we get into that discussion, Kansas City, what do you think about standardized tests and college entrance exams? Are they the proper barometer for kids entering college? Or what tips do you have for those preparing for them? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, and our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Joining us now is the president of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, Gwendolyn Grant, to talk about the importance of the program, and Melva Brownlee, who runs the test prep program in the trenches, is actually joining us as well. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us about the history of the program, Gwen.
We started this program in 2009. We did a pilot to see if we could have some impact on improving ACT scores for urban students. And over the years, we've just really grown the program. We've been very successful. On average, students who participate in our program, which is a four-week test prep program, and then we have an accelerated learning lab on Wednesday evenings, those students who participate have been able to increase their ACT scores by 2 to 3 points.
What's happening differently with the training this year? Is there anything?
Well, we've expanded. We're taking in more and more students, and we were recently awarded the AT&T Aspire Local Impact Grant to expand our program into the Hickman Mills School District to work with ninth grade students.
Well, that's good. Start them early.
Yes.
Speaking of which, why focus on the ACT as opposed to the SAT, the Scholastic Aptitude Test? Does this have anything to do with allegations over the SAT maybe being culturally biased over the years, or is the ACT just what plays in this region?
Well, the ACT is what plays in this region primarily. The SAT is more prevalent on the East Coast and the West Coast, but in the Midwest, the ACT is the most chosen most often. But in this year, actually, the ACT exceeded the SAT in terms of the number of students who choose to take the ACT test over the SAT. Now, with regard to the cultural bias piece, I think that there was some controversy about that in years past, but I think what it has to do more with is that the ACT content is more closely aligned with state standards and with school curricula.
Melva Brownlee, the ACT is also more diverse in the types of subjects that it covers.
Yes, it does. It covers English, math, reading, and science. And with the math part, it covers pre-algebra, elementary algebra, and advanced algebra. There are a few questions around trigonometry and geometry, but 90% of the test is algebra.
So how do you start? Where do you start when a student sits down with you?
Well, we start exactly where they are. Students that have taken the test before, we look at their previous test scores, and we really look at where set a goal for them, really looking at how many they got right in all the areas on the test and what it will take to get them to the next level. We set goals. So, example, if a student came in and they were at 20, that tells us that the student is getting 53% of the questions right. Right. However, we know that's not really good scholarship range for students. So our goal is to get them to 73 to 85%. So that means we have to increase the number of questions they get right. And it needs to be consistent across the board for every subject area. So kids can't fluctuate in each area. They need to be consistent in all of those areas. And that's what we really talk with them about and find out what happened to them on the test.
Do past students come back and help the current students in the workshop?
Sometimes they do. The students really love coming to the program, so they'll come and volunteer and help with registration, but they'll also share their experience with the student and really try to encourage the student around attitude, around preparing for the test day, and really honing in on getting enough rest, because we hammer that with the students, and so students do come back to share that, their experience, as well as give advice about actual test day.
We're talking about a very successful test prep program put on by the Greater Kansas City Urban League. Our guests are Gwendolyn Grant and Melva Brownlee. But we're also opening up the phone lines for a larger question on standardized testing and its efficacy in our educational paradigm today. Mary in North KC, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
We got a little bit of interference there for you, Mary. Go ahead. We'll try to clear that up, but go ahead.
Okay. Well,
we got to drop that. Vicky in Parkville, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Vicky.
Looks like our phone lines are a little bit on the fritz today. Let's try Russ in Overland Park.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now, but the phone lines are still messed up. We'll come back and we'll solve that technical difficulty, and we'll bring it back to our guests here. So, how many students do you typically have in these programs?
We serve typically 200-plus students a year. In each session, 4 weeks prior to the students taking the test, we recruit around 25 to 28 students to be in each session. That number has been chosen because it's been the most effective to break down in small group and individual tutoring, and we just found that that's been real successful for students making the advancements that they need to make on the test.
What's particularly effective about having a small class size, small workshop?
Absolutely. They don't get left behind. Students in classrooms can kind of fall in between the cracks, and if they're quiet, you know, they're okay. But this way, when we have tutors working with the students, they don't have an opportunity to fall by the wayside because the tutor is very in tune with where they are and how they're answering the questions, and they have to be engaged and participate. So each person is going around responding to the questions and understanding what exactly they got right and what they exactly got wrong and what they need to adjust related to the test strategy.
Do you bring volunteers out of the community that specialize in the particular fields for the different subjects on the test? Talk about that.
We do. We prefer to use professionals as tutors. They have worked the best for our program and our students. They are engineers, and they do really well in math. And we have people who work for English, and they do a really good job with that. And then we have students at Park University who are majoring in science. science, and so they've taken the test, and so they understand how to break the science down for the students so that they understand the reasoning that's associated with the science, not necessarily a specific subject matter in science. So the tutors really understand how to break the subject matter down for them.
Gwendolyn, preparing for the test is fair enough. What about life skills? How much does this program focus on life skills? You take the test. What do you need to know going into college, going into life?
We put a lot of emphasis on life skills in our program, and I think that's what sets it apart from many others. The students, our approach to working with young people is an asset-based model of connecting with them early on in the program, having them complete an individual success plan that looks not only at their academic achievement, but what are their goals and aspirations in life. And then we coach them about how they can achieve success. And that is learning how to network and build relationships. Our students are coached on completing resumes. They get business cards. Our juniors and seniors get business cards, and they're encouraged to get out and network and meet people. We coach them about the importance of being consistent in their attendance and prioritizing what's important in their lives. So it does make a huge difference. And we require the parents to participate in the first session. We have a parent engagement session to launch each ACT course. And then the parents are coached by other parents, and we maintain fluid lines of communication between the ACT staff and parents to let them know where the student is, what they need to be doing at home during the week to follow up on what they're learning on Saturdays and on Wednesdays.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're talking about the importance of college test preparation, and our guests are from the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, Urban League Chapter President Gwendolyn Grant, and we also have Melva Brownlee, who runs the actual test prep part, and we're talking about preparing for the ACT. We're going to open up the phone lines back again. We apologize in advance for any technical difficulties that we might encounter. We're going to try that again. Kansas City, are college entrance exams, such as the SAT or ACT, a proper barometer for our children entering college and entering the workforce and life in general, or do you find them to be unfair, biased, or outdated? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also write in at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option, as is Twitter, where our handle is @KCURCST. We're going to go with Russ and try him again. Russ, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, you got it working?
Got it working. That's clear.
Cool. Okay, everyone else should be happy. For what it's worth, I'm the product of an educational system rather than a training system. And I never studied for a test, and I managed to ace the SAT anyway because I was paying attention instead of passing notes and throwing spitballs during class. my view is that while you can train in test-taking techniques, such as don't overeat before you go in, sleep the night before, that sort of thing, training to specific questions just trains you to pass tests, which there are very few positions where you can get paid to pass tests regularly, let alone they don't pay very well. I'm kind of wondering about the idea of, you know, testing to the C, or training to the CSAPs, that sort of thing, as a very, very bad thing. SATs and ACTs are a certain validity because they give an idea of how much attention somebody paid in school, although trying to nudge somebody over in specific areas kind of gives the lie to how much they actually learned in school. Rather, they do well on the test when they with a little bit of prep when they wouldn't have otherwise. It's kind of fudges the figures there. But as far as actual schooling, where they just train you to pass state standardized tests, I consider that to be a great evil because all you are doing is complying with every child left behind at the same place rather than trying to educate to the best of our ability. We used to have a pretty good educational system in parts of this country. These days, we kind of don't.
Thank you, Russ, for your very important points that he makes. Teaching the test versus teaching a well-rounded critical thinking sort of approach. Talk about that. You wanted to address
that.
Yeah,
I think that was a great comment from the statement from the caller. You know, when you look at state standardized tests under the No Child Left Behind Act, what a lot of school districts are doing, I think, is they find themselves teaching to the test so that they can raise their scores. With regard to the ACT, what we do is not teach to the test. What the ACT does for us is when we look at the baseline results, wherever that kid is when they come to us, that gives us an indicator of where they need to be tutored with regard to content mastery. So that what has happened, what we found is when students leave our program, they have actually improved their content awareness and knowledge within those subject areas. And so that then translates into their school performance. Their grades have increased, especially in the math and science areas. We've had students who have come to us, one young lady in particular who was struggling with calculus, and having worked with our tutors, raised her calculus grade from a D to an A. In a very short period of time, because she was getting individual and small group coaching, and the tutor was able to go back and address those skill sets that she missed somewhere along the lines, having fallen through the cracks in the classroom. So we do not promote teaching to the test. What the kids come to us with the various gaps with regard to where they are and where they should be at that particular grade level, and we're able to make gains in that area.
Melba Brownlee, do you have anything to add to that before we go back to the phones?
Absolutely. When we're talking about strategies related to the test, there are some key strategies that students need when they're talking about the ACT, and we really make a point of sharing those strategies with students. For example, in the reading, students will get bogged down in trying to read the entire passage, where that passage is lifted out of a larger work, and it really isn't about the passage, but it's about understanding the tone and mood of the author. Is about understanding the questions that they're asking of you and how they fall. And so we try to teach students those very important strategies so that they don't get bogged down, because the ACT is about time, and we try to help kids gain the amount of time that's necessary to get through the questions.
We're going to go back to Mary in North KC. Welcome to Central Standard, Mary.
Glad to be here. I think it's wonderful what the Urban League is doing. As a former teacher and having taken tests and measurements, you know, I was just struck by all the tests I used to take and what the purpose of tests are. They should be to measure and not to keep children out of college, which I believe happens too often, or makes you take a lesser college than you want. So if, since the Urban League is doing what I think is wonderful, is measuring performance and finding out where deficiencies are and correcting them, and then allowing you to retake the test or take a different test, it's too bad when colleges rely too much on a silly test to determine your intelligence. I mean, they've shown a long time ago that an IQ test is just a measure of whether or not you had a good background at home and whether or not you had a good education at a good school, not necessarily whether or not you have any intelligence. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary, for contributing to the conversation. Very insightful thoughts from Mary in North KC. What do you think about that? Isn't that why it's crucial to begin these test prep programs early?
Yes, absolutely. See, the thing about the ACT or the SAT test is something that colleges and universities do to narrow the field, because they have to have some type of a selection criteria. And actually, data show that neither test is really a great predictor of how successful that student will do in college, because the test, they don't measure, they don't predict work habits, coping skills, motivation, or any of the other traits that will tell you how successful a person will do when faced with a challenge. But it does give you a snapshot of what that student knows at that particular time. And so it's important for organizations like ours and education systems to prepare the students, because throughout life you have to take high stakes tests.
Maybe you should run a scenario, Melva, where a student is trying to study and their roommate has their music up all night. and maybe they know the real world of college.
Right.
We got Vicki in Parkville. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I hope you can hear me now.
We can hear you now, loud and clear.
I used to teach the ACT prep for Park Hill about 12 years ago, and we only had like one night to do math and one night to do science reasoning. And I wanted to comment that the ACT or the SAT is mostly a speed test, as was already mentioned, and so you should, first of all, never spend more than a minute on any question, maybe even more like 30 seconds, and skip it and go on. And the other thing is, for ACT, it never hurts you to guess. And I don't know about the SAT, but if don't leave something blank, fill it in, you might get lucky. And lastly, there are excellent guides in the bookstores, ACT Prep, that the more you take the test, you get a feel for what's going to be asked, what they're looking for. So buy those practice tests and just do them. And the more you do them, the more familiar you get with the speed you're going to have to be at and the type of reasoning, like in science reasoning, which was my field of instruction.
Thank you very much, Vicki, for your thoughts and joining the conversation. We have to move on here, but thank you very much for your thoughts.
Okay.
Is speed very important?
It is, and for each section, each section have a time limit. Like English is 8 minutes and 45 seconds per passage, and in the math, it's basically 1 minute per question, just as the caller stated. And then in science and reading, you have about 6 minutes and 30 seconds. And so we do help the student break down each of those time limits so that they understand exactly how much time they have to deal with the passages and how much time they have to deal with the question. Yes, the ACT is about being efficient with time.
And so is studying, and so is class, and so is professional life,
for
that
matter.
So
is knowledge, right? Really learning something is important.
Jen in the Plaza, welcome to Central Standard. Jen, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Love your show.
Thank you.
I took the ACT 25 years ago.
Right.
And my parents didn't speak English. So the vocab was, as well as the math, was very hard for me because I didn't really know the meaning of a lot of those words, and I didn't realize that until, like, my 10th grade in high school that was going to be a problem. Do you address the language barriers or the differences if English isn't the first language of the parents?
And even if English is the first language, sometimes there are also language barriers with the verbal portions and English portions of the test as well. So language barriers.
Although ACT says they do not measure vocabulary, what they do measure is vocabulary and context. So if you don't know the word, you still you're at a slight disadvantage because you have to understand in the reading, science, and the English, the vocab in context. So we do help students understand, and we've added a portion that we do every 4 weeks to help students with vocabulary that will show up on the ACT test.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the skills that you employ here, the individual success plans. Talk about those.
Sure. It's what we do with that is a way of connecting with the students at the beginning stage as they come into our program. So we have a format of during intake of interviewing or sitting someone working with the student to find out where they are. You look at their baseline test scores, find out about their grades in school, or if they're having any challenges with regard to attendance, behavior, all those issues, and letting the student drive that, because once you do that, that's where the motivation is going to come. You know, here many students have not even been exposed to getting a really clear snapshot of what they look like on paper with regard to their test scores, their state standardized tests, as well as the ACT scores, their grades, and then how does that line up with the career goal that you have? For instance, you say you want to be a doctor, but we look at your curriculum, what you're enrolled in school, and you don't take any math and science classes, or you're not performing well, or you don't have good attendance, but you want to be a doctor. What we say is you can. Now you just have to make the adjustments. So we have to close these gaps. You've got to enroll in advanced placement classes. You've got to take math and science. You've got to do these things. You can get there, but and here's how. So that's why that's a very important aspect of the process.
We've been talking about the importance and the success of a college test prep program with our guests at Urban League of Greater Kansas City, and that chapter president is Gwendolyn Grant, and the facilitator of the ACT
Vice President
of the Greater Urban League of Kansas City chapter is Melva Brownlee, who is also in the trenches helping the kids with their test prep program. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming.
Thank you
so much.
And tune in tomorrow for a roundtable with a discussion on the economic outlaws and what happens when economic outlaws come moseying in to Kansas City. Our show is produced by Tamika Weatherspoon and help from Maria Carter and Danny Alexander on today's show. Thanks, Danny and Maria. Up to Date is next with a look at UMKC's Innovation Center and their digital sandbox. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.